Dr. Silver has asked me to read his review of the year to you this morning. He is rabbinically indisposed, a case of laryngitis. I'm afraid that, as you can hear, I am not a completely healthy substitute. I had planned my annual cold for this morning when I was not to be in the pulpit. But if you will bear with me, we will together explore taking stock of 1961. The year 1961 was a disheveled year, politically speaking. It was full of sound and fury, but it added up to little. No forward step was taken towards peace. There was much coming and going among the world's leaders. They shuttled between Paris, Vienna, Moscow, Washington, London, and Bermuda. But the net result was to sharpen differences and increase tensions. Not a single problem which was acute in 1960 was in any way solved or even mitigated in 1961. Cuba, Berlin, Laos, Vietnam, Algiers, the Congo. The last few weeks of 1961 added to the roster of the world's headaches, Goa and New Guinea. The hardening hostility between the East and the West was best symbolized by the wall, which was erected during the year across the city of Berlin. This wall, figuratively speaking, has been extended, enlarged, and reinforced across the entire globe. And East and West are now more sharply separated and divided than ever before. The Allied statesmen seem to be far apart on nearly all of the great issues. The fear of atomic warfare increased immeasurably among people. In our own country, many of our citizens began to clamor for a national program of fallout shelters, for concrete umbrellas, as it were, against the rainfall of poisonous radiation which would follow a thermonuclear war. The moratorium on nuclear bomb testing broke down completely when the Soviet Union broke off negotiations which were going on for a permanent ban on testing and unilaterally resumed the explosion of powerful atomic bombs in the atmosphere, some of them in the 50 megaton class. The cumulative effect of all that has transpired was reflected most violently, damagingly in the United Nations. The successive acts of defiance of its authority, the cynical disregard of its injunctions by one or another of its constituent power blocks, the willful and one-sided interpretation of the provisions of its charter by member nations whenever it suited their purposes, and the actual refusal of some member nations to pay their share of the cost of the United Nations operations on the ground that they did not approve of the action taken, these have rudely shaken, if not yet undermined, its foundations. The year closes as prophecies of doom are heard in many quarters. The United Nations is dying. The United Nations is rapidly going the way of the League of Nations. Beyond these prophecies, there are people who are even eager to ready the coffin, to write the epitaph. This is perhaps the saddest and the most ominous note which was heard in last year's symphony of pessimism. For there is no substitute for the United Nations but anarchy, war. It was, after all, not long after the League of Nations broke down, the Second World War began. Who was to blame? It would be simple indeed if one could put the accusing finger on a single culprit or two. But in a sense, all the great powers are culpable. Our own government began the year with Cuba, and that was a whopper. A political blunder of the first magnitude, which was quickly followed by humiliating failure. The evil consequences of that rash act have pursued us in all the chancelleries of the world to this day, and the end is not yet. On the international scene, it gave the new administration a bad start. The close of the year saw us, the leader of the free world and the champion of democracy, flattering and praising Franco of Spain, who is as ruthless a dictator as there is in the world today, continuing to underpin his regime with American dollars. The Soviet government under Khrushchev, while officially extolling coexistence, in practice proved to be no more cooperative and conciliatory than under Stalin and Molotov. It did its utmost during the year to hamstring and discredit the United Nations and to hound Hammarskjöld out of office. It climaxed its acts of willfulness and contumely by resuming nuclear testing in defiance of the appeal addressed to it by the United Nations, and to continue to threaten the non-communist world with a fist of 100 megaton bombs. One gathered the impression that Khrushchev, powerful as he undoubtedly is, may not really be free to negotiate because of his critics and dogmatists at home, and because of the undisguised opposition of Red China. Great Britain, and this is the testimony of Dr. Connor Cruz O'Brien, who quit in protest as United Nations chief in Katanga. Great Britain deliberately obstructed the effort of the United Nations to get the foreign mercenaries out of Katanga and encouraged Tshombe's efforts at secession from the Central Congo government. From British Rhodesia, military aid was sent to the Katangan government. Britain publicly threatened to withhold payments to the United Nations if it continued to use force against Katanga. In so doing, it threatened to follow the example of the Soviet Union, which refused to contribute to the cost of the Congo operations because the United Nations would not employ force against Katanga. Neither Britain nor the Soviet Union were guided by principle in the position which they took, or by concern for the authority and the prestige of the United Nations, but only and simply by their own narrow financial and political interests. The government of France under de Gaulle pursued its own nationalist, independent course in the matter of Berlin, and refused to join with the other members of the Western Alliance to open negotiations with the Soviet for the settlement of the Berlin problem and all the related issues. Adenauer, in the face of all practical considerations, kept on pressing for a united Germany and refused to recognize the very existence of East Germany. He would focus all Western diplomacy and the entire strategy of world peace on that one issue, regardless of anything else. And Nehru scuttled his self-righteous peace crusade and his self-assumed role of moral conscience of mankind by an act of military aggression in Goa, an act which blazingly revealed for all to see true nature of the political neutralism which is practiced by some member nations of the United Nations. Khrushchev congratulated Mr. Nehru. The Soviet Union vetoed a resolution in the Security Council which would have asked India to withdraw her invading troops. And culpable also is the now powerful 50-nation African-Asian bloc, which stands to gain most from a strong world organization, both as far as their political defense and their social progress are concerned. A bloc which did nothing to halt or even to express indignation at the Indian invasion of Portuguese Goa, and on several other occasions placed group interests above world interest and above the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. For the Charter of the United Nations does not authorize the use of force to liberate any territories which nations may claim belongs to them. Nor does any resolution of the United Nations, regardless of alleged justification. There are peaceful means provided by the machinery of the United Nations for the settlement of all disputes, and there are ways of enforcing these through the agencies of the United Nations. In the affairs of men and nations, there are moving tides, and there are eddies, whirlpools. These eddies and whirlpools are, as a rule, the more noticeable, but the less permanent. We have witnessed many distressing and perilous international vortices during the past year. These have alerted us to the dangers which are lurking in our world. But we should not overlook the irresistible tides which are moving mankind forward to a better and juster day. The trends everywhere towards the social evolution of the least developed peoples of the world. The concerted efforts which are being made to improve their standards of living, to lessen disease, illiteracy, and poverty, and to eradicate all discriminatory practices based on racial inequality. The movements to help nations to self-government are continuous and unmistakable. They cannot be measured in terms of a single year or even a single generation or decade. These forward-moving, deep-channeled rivers are not free of dangerous rapids and cataracts. Some of the newly established independent and sovereign states are not at all ready for self-government. They are torn by tribal rivalries and beset by illiteracy, superstition. The dark African continent will not become bright and transformed into a world of exemplary, free, and peaceful states in a generation. Nor will the unchanging East change overnight and adopt Western concepts and institutions of democracy. You cannot telescope time and pressure cook a civilization. You can do these, but only up to a point. But history does not always wait upon the ripe and favorable moment, and the gradual and bloodless evolution of nations is a rather rare phenomenon. These peoples of Africa will have to acquire the art of self-government the hard way. The tides are nevertheless moving on, and no one can stop them. In spite of all difficulties, the free world is not only holding its own, but is moving forward. It is consolidating. While on the surface, the free nations are in disagreement on techniques, procedures, in relations to this or that issue, a centripetal force is at work in the democratic world. A cheering evidence of this truth is to be found in the successful and the expanding European common market, which now embraces 6 continental countries, but which may soon embrace also Britain, Norway, and Denmark, and in time may include in a working arrangement also the United States, as well as Canada, and other members of the British Commonwealth. This economic union will soon encompass hundreds of millions of people, and will constitute the largest single market in the world. It is not unwarranted to hope for a growing political integration of the free world as a consequence of this economic integration. Another evidence of the strong tides that are moving is the Alliance for Progress, which was launched last year. It is a 10-year plan of economic aid for Latin America, to which the United States committed itself to contribute $1 billion annually to help these people to a better life, better homes, more work, more land, better health, and more and better schools. This is conditioned upon certain minimal economic reforms which the governments of the Latin American countries have committed themselves to introduce. The efforts of our government to come closer to the peoples of Latin America, the friendship visits of our Vice President and Mr. Adlai Stevenson, head of our delegation to the United Nations, to some of these South African countries, and more recently the visit of President Kennedy to Caracas and Bogota, were intended to undergird this Alliance for Progress, and as such, they were far-sighted steps and extremely beneficial. We could not but applaud the forthright manner of approach of the President of the United States, the honest acknowledgement of past mistakes, the sincere desire evidenced in concrete acts of assistance and cooperation, and the determination to turn over a new page and to work together to build a just and free society in the Western Hemisphere. There were episodes in our own South during the year, such as the arrest of freedom riders, other anti-Negro demonstrations which continued to focus attention on the prime unsolved problem of American democracy. But below the surface eddies of these conflicts and acts of resistance, the irresistible rivers were moving on in their deep channels. School integration went on, even if the pace was slow. In interstate transportation, in restaurants, in employment, in the right to register to vote, and in the matter of restricted neighborhoods, progress was made. As long as our government will stand squarely behind all measures of civil rights, progress will be made. Racial and religious intolerance dies hard, even in such countries like the Soviet Union, which never misses an opportunity to denounce us for our share of it. Peace Corps, which was established during 1961, belongs to these same on-moving tides. This was not a monumental contribution, but it should not be ignored. Perhaps it is to be likened to that little cloud, the size of a man's hand rising out of the sea, which announced to Elijah the prophet that the years of severe drought were about to end, that the heavens would soon grow black with cloud and wind, and that the great and blessed rains would soon descend upon the land. The Peace Corps proposal was a new note. It was a clarion call to men to come to the aid of their fellow men in need in all other parts of the world, bypassing all politics, all ideologies, bypassing the Cold War. Not to destroy communism, not to save democracy, but only to help other human beings, men and women and children, the underprivileged of the earth, the timeless victims of ignorance and disease and poverty, to help them, to help themselves. What a noble call this to the human spirit, and how truly responsive it is to the best in our proud American tradition. Another event in 1961 which attracted worldwide attention was the trial of Adolf Eichmann. From the moment of his apprehension, And throughout the lengthy trial and the months which preceded the verdict for the court, I refused to make any public comments, although I was frequently asked to express an opinion on one or another of its phases. I saw no reason for doing so. That Eichmann should have been brought to trial, no reasonable man could question. Hundreds of other men, charged with crimes committed during the Second World War, had been brought to trial in Allied countries and were sentenced, some to prison terms, others to death. The Western Allies tried some 20,000 Nazis as war criminals. Our own country participated in the famous Nuremberg trials, where 11 of the foremost Nazi leaders and military men were tried for crimes committed against peace, war crimes, and for crimes against humanity, and were sentenced to death. The defendants were tried and convicted according to the text of the indictment, not alone for crimes against peace and for war crimes, but, and Dr. Silver quotes here, for crimes committed against humanity, for crimes committed against humanity, both within Germany and within occupied territories, including murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhuman acts committed against civilian populations before and during the war, and persecution on political, racial, and religious grounds. These Nazi crimes against humanity were spelled out in great detail and documented in the indictment. They were carried out by devious means, including shooting, hanging, gassing, starvation, kickings, beatings, brutality, torture of all kinds, and the performance of experiments by means of operations and otherwise on living human subjects. They conducted deliberate and systematic genocide, namely, the extermination of racial and national groups. In this connection, it is proper to recall that the infamous Julius Streicher was sentenced by the International Military Tribunal and hanged on this one count in the indictment: crimes against humanity. Unlike Eichmann, he did not himself carry out the Nazi program of annihilating the Jewish race. But as Jew baiter number one of Germany, he incited the German people to active persecution of the Jews and to bringing about their extermination. He infected the German mind with the virus of anti-Semitism by his speeches and articles week after week, month after month. In other trials conducted by the United States in Nuremberg, 1,672 Nazis faced the court, and 258 were executed. I was certain that Eichmann, who was known to have been directly responsible for carrying out Hitler's criminal program of extermination of the Jews, the program of the so-called final settlement of the Jewish question, I was certain that he would receive a fair trial at the hands of an Israeli court. Before all the evidence was presented in the court, before the defense had been fully heard, before the verdict of the judges had been rendered, what was there to say? And now, at the almost unbelievable story of human cruelty and depravity, unmatched in the annals of mankind, has been finally told and recorded in testimony, presented during more than 16 weeks. Now that the accused defense and self-exculpation during 4 weeks on the stand has been heard, and the complete story and sifting of the evidence of 100 witnesses and 1,400 documents by the judges has been given to the world, and their unanimous verdict of guilt has been announced, what is there to say other than what the whole world is saying? That the trial was eminently fair, that the verdict was eminently just. Even the government of West Germany has voiced its approval. Here and there a voice is raised, not in defense of Eichmann's innocence, but in mitigation of the death sentence. I can understand it if the argument is made by those who are opposed on principle to capital punishment. I cannot understand it when it is argued that death is too good for Eichmann, that he should be allowed to live and suffer, perhaps in lifelong solitary confinement, to reflect upon and to expiate for his crimes, and so that he may serve as an example and a warning. This is a form of sadism which I believe is repugnant to civilized men. Some have maintained that life imprisonment rather than a death sentence would be good public relations, a noble gesture, perhaps. But that was not the task of the judges. They were charged with the responsibility of declaring the guilt or innocence of the accused, and whether there were any extenuating circumstances to warrant leniency. They found none. Clemency rests with the President of the State of Israel, to whom an appeal for clemency by the convicted Eichmann has not yet been made. This ends Dr. Silver's review of 1961. What of 1962? I am not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, and you must allow his words in succeeding weeks to fill you in on the future.